Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning.
Good morning.
It is a joy to sit in this hall again. Even if I wasn't sitting in this seat, it would be a joy to sit in this hall again. It has been far too long. Last week, Anand spoke of dukkha, the first noble truth, and the effects of the pandemic on Dharma practice. And this is from the blurb that went out in the newsletter. So if it sounds familiar, I'm not just repeating myself. It's okay. In this week's talk, I'm going to look at Dharma as PPE, or personal protective equipment. So a little context for this topic, especially for people who are listening to this talk years and years and years from now, new people coming to the Dharma who are looking through the website, looking for old talks, and maybe they've forgotten we've had a pandemic. Maybe the world is a little different. Maybe there's a different crisis or stressor that is capturing people's attention. But to give a little context for this talk, for those future listeners, we're 8 months now into this coronavirus pandemic. Oregon and Washington have issued travel advisories for people to quarantine if they travel to or from other states. And we're in the midst of a 2-week freeze that was issued by the governor. Not quite another lockdown, but close. And last night I went down a rabbit hole looking at the data dashboards on the Oregon Health Authority website. There's so much information displayed in such a concise way about how many people have been tested, how many are positive, how many are negative, how full are the hospitals, how much PPE does each hospital have? And this talk is not necessarily about the pandemic, but it does use some of the vocabulary that is becoming familiar to us from living through these times of this pandemic. So as was my habit before a talk, I was casting about for a topic. And I was at work at a local hospital thinking, nuts, I'm scheduled for the talk this Sunday. What am I going to talk about? And I asked this of one of the Buddhist chaplains in the hospital. There are three of us there, three Buddhist chaplains. There are many more chaplains in general, but three Buddhist chaplains. And I said, what should I talk about this Sunday? I'm scheduled for a talk. I can't think of anything. And he was standing there with his mask and his face shield and his gloves. And he looked down and he looked up at me and he says, Dharma is PPE. I was like, huh. And then we both realized we were late for a meeting and I never had a chance to like elaborate. So this is my examination of his question of Dharma as PPE, or his idea about Dharma as PPE. So sometimes when we talk about Buddha, sometimes we talk about Buddhism, we talk about Buddha as the great physician, the great healer. Dukkha is the illness, that dissatisfactoriness that saturates each moment. It's the illness. And Dharma is medicine, that which brings relief and brings healing. The Eightfold Path then becomes the course of treatment. How is this medicine applied? So oftentimes, if we're looking at Dharma in this way, it's often considered medicine or something nutritive, something that nurtures, something that is nutritious, something that feeds us. And when you read Dogen, that pops up a lot also. How much emphasis is placed on the role of head cook? Sometimes when we're talking about cooking and eating and feeding, it's not just about the food. It's about how do we take in Dharma? How do we take in this practice? How do we take in that which is wholesome. So what might it be to look at Dharma as PPE, as protective, as opposed to nutritive? So why is this important? One, this is an intriguing idea, and I often find that it's useful to re-examine comfortable ideas from different perspectives. So for me, this idea of Dharma as food is comfortable. It's familiar. It's part of my inner vocabulary. Of course, Dharma is nurturing. So what is it to take that and look at it from a slightly different perspective? How is it protective? And what can be learned by questioning our own internal values this way? So what am I defining as Dharma for this particular talk? We can think of Dharma in many ways. We can think of it as the Buddha's teachings, sort of on the relative end of the scale. The Buddha's teachings, that which is taught, that which is instructive. We can go all the way to the other end of the spectrum, big mind, abstract view, Dharma as reality as it is. This very world unfolding in this moment is also Dharma. So for this talk, I think I'm going to come back to that more relative end of the scale. Dharma as we often think of it. So big D Dharma as we often think of it. Buddha's teachings, or the teachings of Buddhism, or that which has been passed down to us through this tradition. And so how can this serve as protective? We have our precepts, our guidelines for moral and ethical relating. And those certainly prevent us from falling into unskillful action if we apply ourselves to them, if we invite them in, if we allow them to shape our lives and our actions. We have our practices around reflection, taking the time to examine the things that we have done and said and how we relate to people. Are those skillful, unskillful? In a way, that's part of that nurturing aspect. But when we take it on as a habit, the force of that habit becomes protection. The force of that habit becomes preventative from doing something unskillful if we already know that we have a habit or a tendency to do something harmful. Knowing it, we can refrain. Reflection prevents hurts and resentments from accreting and festering. And so when we think of PPE, personal protective equipment, whether it's, you know, I often think of it as the mask and the face shield and the gloves and the gowns, the things I see in the hospital so often. PPE prevents harm from coming in, prevents us from exposure to harmful substances. And it protects others from our own harm. These masks that we're all wearing are less about us taking in a virus than protecting others from a virus we may carry without knowing it. So that protection goes both ways. So in terms of Dharma, or Dharma practice, this prevents us from taking in harmful or unskillful things by knowing ourselves and what our limits are. Through this practice, through working with these teachings, we understand ourselves in a very intimate way, a very personal way. We get to know good from bad and cultivate the to cultivate the tendency to pursue good as opposed to bad, unskillful, harmful. And I want to read a small, short section from the Dhammapada, very old collection of Dharma, of verses on Dharma teachings. This is from a chapter called State of Woe. Yikes. If anything is undertaken, do it impeccably. Poorly led monastic life stirs up the dust of passions more widely. I love that. It's not enough to undertake a monastic life. You can't take the form and not do the practice. Do the practice. If anything is undertaken, do it impeccably. Poorly led monastic life stirs up the dust of passions more widely. Better to avoid doing evil and not suffer the torment that follows. Better to do what is right and not suffer the regret. Just as a border town is protected within and without, so let one guard oneself and not let the opportunity pass. To neglect that opportunity is to invite suffering. Some are ashamed of what is not shameful and shameless about what is shameful. Following such false views, they go to a sorrowful state. Some are fearful where there is nothing to fear and are fearless where there is much to fear. Holding such false views, they go to a sorrowful state. Some see what is right as wrong and what is wrong as right. Holding such false views, they go to a sorrowful state. And those who see wrong and right as right hold right views and go to a joyful state. I like this verse, or these set of verses, because they talk about the importance of engagement, of action, of discerning, of putting effort into our practice and how we respond to the world. But these verses also have a little bit of a problem in that there is such repetition of right and wrong. Skillful and unskillful, perhaps, is a better translation. But here, it is left up to us to decide what is right and wrong. And in our culture, we have so many habits around deciding things are wrong, or assuming things are wrong, or assuming we are wrong, based on past conditioning. So hear these words not as a relative right or wrong, but as engage in activities that lead towards wholesomeness, that lead towards skillfulness, and know yourself well enough to know what that means for you. Because there's not an absolute outside of you that you need to compare your life to. In Buddhism, in the Wisdom Sutras, there are teachings about the bodhisattvas armed with the great armor. This is another place this protective aspect of Dharma arises. Bodhisattvas, when engaged in their practice, when doing their practice, are armed with the great armor. Armed with the paramitas, armed with the perfection of wisdom as they cultivate it. Armed with knowing that in a very fundamental way, there is no one to be wounded. They can cultivate the courage to be present with others and witness to the suffering around them. There are all these Dharma teachings that fall under this label, Dharma. But the aspect of Dharma that is serving this protective function is not so much Dharma as a thing, but when we are in relationship to it, when we know it, when we recognize it, are aware of it, and reflect upon it. This is when wisdom arises. the perfection of wisdom, the highest perfection. So let's invert this for a second, or rather change gears slightly. Look at it from a different angle. Just as we wouldn't set aside PPE just because it's uncomfortable or it gets in the way, we wouldn't discard it because it's an inconvenience. Also, don't discard Dharma practice because at times it is inconvenient or it is uncomfortable. Those are the times that we might need it most. Those are those times of transformation that are possible. So Dharma leads us from suffering to ease, from unwholesomeness to wholesomeness, unskillfulness to skillfulness. But the key part of this here becomes the importance of meaning-making. The Dharma becomes protective when we allow it to shape our meaning-making, when the stories we tell about ourselves, the stories we tell ourselves about who we are shaped by Dharma narratives, values, intentions, and motivations. Not in a doctrinal way, but in a deeply personal, unique way. Kyogen used to talk about being ordained into your life, and in a way, this is a part of it. When we allow ourselves to be shaped, transformed, trained by encountering the Dharma, whether as study or community or pondering, all of this is protective. Think for a moment, those of you who have taken Jukai, that moment, the end of the ceremony, and there's that beautiful dedication, and it says, you are just as we. The bodhisattvas are saying, you are just as we are. You have taken the Buddha for your teacher and the bodhisattvas for your friends. All of us, that's not true. Let me back up. Most of us have come to this practice from a different tradition as converts, either from another religion or from no religion at all. And so as we study Dharma, there is this aspect of learning, becoming familiar with, allowing ourselves to be open to it, and letting it sink in, letting it begin to shape our internal experience and the language we use with ourselves in our own mind. This begins to shape our worldview. And this aspect of worldview influences where we find meaning. And this is something I see so often, especially in my training right now in the hospital. Something happens. Someone becomes ill. Someone becomes hurt. Someone close to us dies. And then there's this question of why? What happened? What do I do now? Who am I without that person? And these questions are ones of how do we make meaning out of our experience? And for those of us who come to this practice from no past religious history or another religious history or tradition, we'll often find that in times of crisis, sometimes what comes out of our mouth in terms of where I get my meaning is from a Buddhist view, and sometimes it's from an older view. And that's okay. we make sense of the world? How do we make sense of this pandemic? I have listened to people talk about it as a curse or a plague. I've also heard people talk about it as causes and conditions. Something that is just arising in the moment that we meet as best we can. All of these are different ways to make meaning and different ways of relating to the world. And so finding ways that are congruent with our sense of self is a path towards ease. The Dharma protects when we ask it to protect, because it is no different than our experience arising and our relationship to that experience. It's so funny doing this talk. I want that chaplain here so I can say, look, this is what I came up with for your question or your topic. He would probably just laugh at me and then give me my floor assignment. So what do you think? Those of you in the room and those of you on Zoom, this whole talk has been an exploration of just looking at this question of our relationship to Dharma from a perspective that at least I hadn't really thought of before. In a way, it's been a thought exercise, and also in a way, it helps pry at that idea of this is that and lets it be a little bit more loose, a little bit more open. So with that, I'll take comments or questions.
So when you started talking about this, the word that came up for me was refuge. And because I think that's pretty much, you know, there's this Matisse around where they say, I take refuge in, or I go to the Buddha for refuge, I go to the Dharma for refuge, I go to the Sangha for refuge. And there is that same two-sided nature of it that I've heard talked about where we are both taking refuge for ourselves, but also giving refuge to other people as a way of protecting them. Just wanted to throw that word in there because that's a more traditional word, but I think it's basically the same kind of thing.
It is, and I deliberately did not use the term refuge because it is one of those. It's a key word in Buddhism, but it can also be shortcutted. And I think, yes, that applies.
Yeah, it's nice to see it in a different, from a different perspective, but yes.
Yeah. Does that need to be restated, Yutan, for the Zoom folks?
I don't think so. I think we heard it pretty well. I did, anyway. Next, we have a question from Veju on Zoom.
Sure.
Oh, I have yet to give them, everyone, the opportunity to unmute. There you go. Reju, can you unmute now?
Yes. Thank you, Joshin. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I have a piece of confusion about what I think is maybe a dichotomy. I'm struggling with knowing what needs protection and what needs openness and how they're the same or different. And I worry both about being too protective and closing off intimacy and also being too open and getting hurt from not keeping myself safe. And I wonder if I can be, if it's possible to be completely present and also protective.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think one of the key words I heard you say is safety. And I think without a sense of safety, then aiming for openness, you risk adding hurt on top of hurt. And we put on as much protection as possible if we're worried that we're not safe. And so I would say if there's a way to cultivate a sense of, in each moment, keying into that sense of safety. Because it's not a static thing. Each moment will be different and the context will be different. And it might be with some people where there is trust, there is more openness. And in other situations when that sense of safety is waving its arms and trying to get your attention and saying, I'm not so sure about this, then there is more of a need for protection. And in those moments, reaching for Dharma as protection may look like grounding into your own sense of aspiration. Or it may be holding healthy boundaries. Or it may be remembering that all things are impermanent. So it will be different each time. But the more you know yourself, and the more you know your motivation, the more you know whether you're pushing yourself too hard or whether you're trying to hide. Does that make sense? I think it's something that all of us do. Shinji's got a question.
I think I'm so far from the mind moving from a little closer. Not so much a question as in thinking of Dharma as protection, I think of the Noble Eightfold Path. So, for example, right speech and right action. And it seems to me that the Dharma can protect us from ourselves, from our karmic tendencies that are not wholesome or our misguidedness. So somebody says something to me that really upsets me and I'm about to really let them have it. You know, right speech is, whoa, wait a minute. You know where this is going to lead. It's not going to lead to happiness. It's just going to dig you into a hole of suffering. And so I'm protected from my own previous tendencies to go wrong.
Yeah. And, you know, leaning into the Dharma, when you're willing to risk that first moment of self-discipline, and you feel that relief of, oh, it's okay, there's more of a capacity to trust that next instant of needing to have some self-discipline, to have a sense of restraint.
Right.
And it's, we learn that trust little by little and learn to let it help us little by little.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because there is definitely a moment of risk.
Yeah.
When you say, oh, I'm wrong there.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm going to shift gears.
Yeah, and being able to sit with everything that arises in that moment of recognition of, I'm wrong. Whether it's embarrassment, it's shame, it's discomfort, it's wanting to cry or hide or lash out. All of that comes up in an instant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we take that moment of risk.
Yay.
That's a good point.
Thank you.
Next, we have a comment from Kapalong.
Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Very well.
The PPE thought is fascinating and really productive. It may come as a surprise to no one that, like, my motorcycles are broken again, and so I've been digging around in their guts a lot. And their guts are very pointy, and there's a lot of, you know, stuff you don't want to get on yourself. But you have to, right? Like, you have to get in there to do the repair and make the thing work again, which is exponentially more difficult if you don't take a moment to gear up properly. And just the idea of, like, being in the trades and there's, like, a lot of baggage around whether you're going to gear up and what that means, and watching people go through lots of gyrations to not gear up and do something that would be easier were they to. It's very apt. Like, it's a really nice apt conceit in thinking about my own fumblings around in Dharma world and wanting to do this and not do that, and that dance between, you know, our willingness to undertake things, as Shinyu says, and to step forward into what probably will be a great idea, you know, probably be productive, but requiring kind of dropping a sense of who you think you are or what you think you should be doing to undertake the done thing. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for giving something to gnaw on.
I like your phrase of taking the time to gear up.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes our practice is taking the time to center ourselves before starting a conversation or before initiating an activity.
Mm-hmm.
It's that pause before work practice. It's that pause before having a hard conversation. To bring our intention.
Yeah, there's an affectionate meticulousness.
Yeah, you jump on your motorcycle without your helmet and go screaming down the highway. Might not have a good outcome.
Yeah, but dude, that's what, like, cool guys do. That's the self that I want to harden into.
Next, we have a question from Tony.
Sure.
Yeah, my question is about this word safety.
Mm-hmm.
I hear what everyone is saying, and I'm not contradicting it, but somehow every time I hear this word safety, I cringe a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So can you comment on the downsides of safety? After all, an awful lot of the awful things in the world come about from people's overreaction to feeling unsafe and the necessity to be safe at all costs, no matter what harm it does.
Yeah, we can certainly cling to it the same way we can cling and grasp to anything else. I'm curious about your cringing, though.
It's that. It's this sense of how much harm there is in the world from this over-reliance on this word safety. Safety,
yeah,
not used as refuge.
Mm-hmm.
Safety used as somehow having to fix the whole world so that nothing bad ever happens to me. That sense of nothing bad must ever happen to me. I don't care how much hurt I do in the world to build this giant wall around me to keep me safe.
Yeah.
I will do it. And then, I mean, an arms race is an overreaction to the pathology of safety, right? I mean, there cannot be too much protection. It's that sense.
Yeah.
And that involves the opposite of everything everyone's been talking about, that you've been talking about. It's not about I acknowledge my own wrongness. It's not about I take a moment to gear up. It's that, damn you, I'm going to be safe. Right.
There is definitely a way to grasp that term and have it become a fundamental delusion. And in a way that craving is, like, it's very much related to that very root cause of suffering, that clinging to a sense of I am and I need, and that craving for existence. And one of the root teachings in Buddhism is that it's the truth of impermanence, that things will change. And so when I'm using this word safety in terms of being safe enough to take a risk in terms of practice, it is still with that Buddhist view that things are going to change. And at the same time, if we are in a chaotic situation where there's not safety, that's problematic. It's hard to practice. At the same time, if we grasp and try to solidify it into a thing or a state that we will have and therefore everything will be okay, that also is a deluded view. And so with all aspects of Buddhism, we always point back to this middle way idea that it's not at one end of the spectrum and it's not at the other end of the spectrum, but it's at the middle, maybe not a middle point, but near the middle. What is enough? What is enough that we can function wholeheartedly and relate with skill and at the same time not turn it into a concrete thing to grab, to try to create, and especially to try to foist on others. So my sense of safety is unique to me, and it is certainly wrapped around my own karma and my own sense of risk and my own sense of my own ego cleaning. Somebody else might have a very different idea of what safety means for them based on their karma and their sense of risk and their willingness to be vulnerable or not. And so when we relate to people, we're always, that's part of that negotiation. Does that make sense at all? Am I meeting your question?
Oh yeah, absolutely. But always in the back of my mind is, that's not the way most people think. Most people really want to foist their idea of safety on me, whether I like it or not.
Yeah, and when that happens, what happens? You're like, uh-uh. That's not a productive relationship.
Yep, so, that's the world. That's most of the world. You can't not have a productive relationship with most of the world.
Well, we can understand that there are delusions out there. Try to meet them with gentleness.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you for your time. It's so good to see you, Joshin.
It's good to see you too.
Tony's point brought up a bunch of words in my head, and I just wonder if there's a way, like some Legos you can pass down together. So safety, okay, you can go overboard, or you can, you know, Tony sounds insulted in a way by other people's ideas or delusions about that. And then these words came up for me, like plan B, redundancy, and compassion in our practice. Isn't it responsible for us in our practice to have a plan B, and can that be translated as compassion when what you think is going to be a safe way to move about doesn't work? I'm also thinking about, you know, I was trained as a neighborhood emergency team person, and there's that word redundancy shows up a lot in the training mm-hmm. and in the manuals and stuff. And it always kind of made you feel a little weird, but it can happen in any aspect of life. Another example could be parenting. You know, parents always have to have a plan B, you know, to just pull out of the air when something
mm-hmm.
doesn't work. So would you speak on that, please?
Sure. I think there's a...
Okay. Summarize.
Sure. So, Nancy has some thoughts come up in response to hearing Tony speak, and part of what Nancy is asking about is, in terms of safety, the necessity for having a plan B or having a backup as part of that sense of safety? Is that okay? Am I paraphrasing
right? Yeah.
Okay. I think that is true, that for some people having a plan B helps. Knowing if this doesn't work, I can do that. And sometimes we can overthink that, and it can become part of a circle of anxiety, of always like, okay, what's next? if I don't have this, what else is going to happen? And if that other thing happens, then I can do this. And then if that goes sideways, I can do this. And then that can become entrapping in a way. So when we engage in practice, and this is going back to what Shinya was bringing up, when we were talking about risking just a little bit and then learning to trust, that we can let ourselves be seen, that we can have some self-discipline to not cause harm. As practice continues, oftentimes that necessity to plan and think out a plan B relaxes, and there becomes a trust in that, oh, whatever arises, I can respond to it. And so it's not necessarily mapping out, if this thing happens, I'll do that. But when this thing happens, I know I can do this. That inclination to do this other aspect arises. And so in your example, that inclination towards compassion, right? We don't have to plan compassion. But when we're attentive to the people in front of us, compassion arises. And it doesn't need to be thought about or planned, but it just, there it is. There's that moment of connection. There's that moment of empathy. There's that moment of really trying to understand another person.
Thank you.
Next, we have a comment from Joe.
Did you say from Joe? Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Yes, I did say from Joe. Sorry, I couldn't find you.
That's okay. And I'm not going to put the video on because I'm in my pajamas, so I don't want to frighten anyone. But Joshin, thank you. Thank you so much for your Dharma talk, and also really excited to hear from you 2 months into your internship, and obviously would love to hear more. And when I saw the title of the Dharma talk, I was so pleased to even put PPE and Dharma in the same realm. And just in listening to people's comments and listening to your talk, it's got me thinking also that PPE itself is a part of Dharma. Of course, everything is Dharma. But when I think as a hospice chaplain that I am going out into the community with community spread and all of the concerns and all of the realities, but then what do? I show up with the PPE like you do at the hospital. I show up with the PPE and I'm sensible and pragmatic and epidemiologically minded. And then I'm also seeing that what happens next is I'm leaning into the Dharma in clarified ways that are different than perhaps pre-pandemic and also not different. You know, when I'm with patients and families, people who are dying, the Dharma is right under my feet all the time. But I'm seeing that I'm leaning into it in a different way because there's so much more vulnerability in a sense and so much unknown and risk, but also safety in loving connection with those that I'm with. So anyway, I would love to hear your thoughts around, yes, you still show up. So you're showing up sensibly at the hospital, I'm sure, with your PPE. And then you're also leaning into the expanse of the Dharma that is supporting you with all of the other stuff. Does that make sense, Joshin?
A little bit. Can you...
I guess sometimes how we can see that spirituality negates pragmatism, like that spirituality is so practical, like we lean into the practical aspects of being human, which includes physically wearing PPE. And then when things get even more stressful, like they are right now, I find that the Dharma becomes even more pertinent because we also need the support of the teachings and the trust of the teachings and the ways that we're held in a sense of interconnectedness and the wisdom that's constantly activated, whether we know it or not. It feels really esoteric, and I'm trying to put words on it, but I hope maybe I sharpened my focus a little bit more. Are you getting what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, and I think you did a wonderful job of speaking to the point that you're asking me to speak of. But yes, Joe, yes. We put on the PPE. We try to keep ourselves safe. We try to keep others safe. There is an aspect that is very practical. This is what we do. And it's still so important to connect. And practice is slowing down. So we have the time to explain, yes, I'm wearing this face shield to protect you and to protect me. And I'm still here. We take the time to pause and check in with a nurse that is harried and her floor is in chaos, or she's dealing with a patient that is unruly and trying to leave against medical advice, or her favorite patient just died. For you, it might be meeting the family members who are in distress, meeting family members who are asking why, who are engaging in that meaning-making. Here is this big event. Their loved one is on hospice. Their loved one is dying. Why? Why is this happening to them? I hear it time and again. And yet, that simple human interaction is so important. Whether or not it doesn't matter what we're wearing. And I think that's one of the fundamentals of Dharma that I love so much, that I find so supportive in my work, in my training, that when it comes down to it, it's just meeting the person in front of you. The clothes don't matter, the equipment doesn't matter, the setting doesn't matter. There's a need. How do you respond? It is very pragmatic. And when I first came to Buddhism, it was the fact that it was pragmatic that attracted me. I didn't want something that was going to ask me to believe in other worlds or miracle cures or whatever. It said, look, life is hard. Here are some ways for it to be not quite so hard. Don't believe me, try it out. And that was the essence that I took from it at the very beginning. So I tried it out. I took that moment to risk. And I don't know how many of you know my story of coming to practice, but coming to the temple freaked me out and I didn't come back for a year. All of the forms were weird, uncomfortable. But eventually, I wanted to practice with people. And so I came back and I took that risk to try. It's pragmatic, it's practical. But over the years, what I've learned is that in spite all of the ways that my upbringing has taught me to defend myself, to protect myself, the ways I was doing that weren't that great. I had to relearn new ways, and that was scary. But I can sit here now and say, I can sit in a room with a stranger and say, I can see you really love your mom. Tell me about her. And just invite them to share their pain with me. And that is practice. And I do it, and I know you do it, Joe. And I think everybody here can do that. I think we all do that. And most of the time we don't recognize that we're doing it. That's the beauty of community. Whether it's community in the temple or community in a hospice or community in a hospital. Does that work?
I'll say, yeah, thanks, Josh. Thanks for all you do.
We have one more comment on Zoom from Eric.
Good morning, Jiushin. Thanks for your talk. It's nice to see you back in the Zendo. Welcome home.
Thank you.
I was working with your metaphor as you were talking and just applying it, of course, to me. And I was aware of the fact that the way I've tended to use protective equipment is to, as some people have suggested, protect myself from myself. My own suffering has been so confusing and so frightening that in the beginning I felt like I just needed some kind of force shield to keep my own suffering away. But this practice, of course, is a developmental process. And I'm aware that over the course of my development as a Buddhist, that I relate to my suffering very differently, and that over time, rather than always wearing my protective equipment anytime, anywhere, any circumstances, I'm slowly taking off my protective equipment, looking more directly, looking longer at my own suffering, pursuing my own suffering, not necessarily eagerly, but recognizing how important it is that as long as I am tracking my own suffering, the pathway out of my suffering is more apparent to me. Mm-hmm. I was reading some of Thich Nhat Hanh's writing the other day, and he was talking about the holy path. The holy path is what we're describing, which is moving into our suffering and not being afraid of it and recognizing that that's where our liberation comes from. So by the end of your talk, I was thinking, how delightful that in my lifetime I have shed so much protective equipment that has separated me from myself, from others, from just joy, a quiet joy, not always a jump up and down joy, but just a quiet joy. And that's what I love about this practice. And I just thank you for your talk, and would appreciate any other comments you have.
Thank you. I have seen you change over time, Eric. I have seen the effects the practice has had on you and how you show up. And so I know your words aren't just words. And you talk about that quiet joy. And what popped up in my mind is just that word satisfaction. If dukkha is often translated as dissatisfaction or dissatisfactoriness, then there is this satisfaction that can arise from practice. Now, you're using the words PPE in a little bit different way than I did in my talk, but even in doing so, you had insight into your own patterns, your own karma, and your own way of how practice has shaped you over time. And that's lovely. One of the strangest things about giving a Dharma talk is that everybody hears it a little bit different, and everybody hears what they need. So in your comments, I hear that you heard what you needed. And it's a gift to know that. So thank you for sharing that.